We don't quite have a quorum, but I'll call this meeting of the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee to order. And seeing as we don't have a quorum yet, we do have a quorum now. So I'll move House File 295 then, now that we have a quorum. This is going to, I should look at my minutes here, going to Commerce. So Representative Elkins, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 295 is a bill that would outlaw most cases of non-compete agreements, which are employment clause provisions that say that if you're going to come to work here, you can't go to work in any defined in the agreement. It puts limitations on where you can work for a period of time after you leave the employment of that employer. And they've become much more prevalent over the last decade or so in various fields and at different income levels. I know when I was first starting my career, I worked for five different airlines setting airfares in succession. And in today's world, I could never have had that kind of a career because each one of those five airlines would have said that, no, you can't go to work for another airline. My younger daughter ran into a problem with non-compete. She was working in Georgia, quit her job to take a new job, and she appeared for work on the first day at the new job, and they put a non-compete agreement under her nose, which was extremely broad, and she refused to sign it and said that you can't have the job. So I have with me today Mary Hogan from the Fed. She's filling in for Ryan Nunn, who is one of the nation's leading experts researching in this field. Ryan apparently tested positive for COVID this morning. He won't be, but Mary is filling in for her and will be delivering the testimony that Ryan would have presented if he did not have COVID.
And members, there's a letter in your packet. Is that the one or
no?
Anyway, there's a letter. The letter, the testimony is in your packet. Mm-hmm. There it is.
Yep.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Hogan, and I'm a senior policy analyst with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. As Representative Elkins noted, I'm filling in for my colleague Ryan Nunn this morning or this afternoon. So here's his testimony. Good afternoon. Thank you to the chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify regarding research on non-compete contracts. My name is Ryan Nunn. I am the Assistant Vice President for Applied Research in the Community Development and Engagement Division at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. I'm an economist with a focus on analysis of labor market institutions, including non-compete contracts, which I have worked on at the U.S. Treasury, the Brookings Institution, and now the Minneapolis Fed. The views I express today are my own and not necessarily those of the Minneapolis Fed or anyone else associated with the Federal Reserve System. I am glad the committee is focused on this important issue. Minnesota and many other states face a range of workforce challenges, and it is becoming increasingly clear that non-competes are part of that story. I will spend the bulk of my time describing what we have learned about non-competes, including how they affect workers, businesses, and the overall economy. Just 10 years ago, it was widely believed that non-compete contracts were predominantly found among executives and high-tech workers. A number of studies focused on those groups, generating valuable information about how they affect migration patterns, career paths, and other outcomes. And to be sure, non-competes are somewhat more common among executives, high-tech workers, and those with higher wages generally. But what we did not know at the time is that non-competes are common throughout the labor market, including millions of workers without college degrees. The first researcher to discover this was Professor Evan Starr of the University of Maryland, who conducted his own survey to gain a comprehensive understanding of non-competes throughout the labor market. Inspired by Professor Starr, the Bureau of Labor Statistics incorporated questions about non-competes into recent rounds of key long-running surveys. My colleagues and I used those new data to estimate that 13% of mid-career workers with just a high school degree reported having a non-compete. Similarly, 12% of workers earning less than $20 per hour reported having a non-compete. These rates are likely underestimates because many workers are unaware of having the contracts until it is pointed out to them by their employer. Unfortunately, available sample sizes do not support a reliable state-specific estimate for Minnesota. But my best guess, extrapolating from national data, is that almost 350,000 workers have non-competes in our state. These are large numbers. I believe it is this realization that non-competes are ubiquitous that has accelerated researcher and policymaker efforts to understand and address issues surrounding non-competes. In a few moments, I will describe research on the economic effects of non-competes. But before doing so, I find it helpful to think through typical justifications for non-compete contracts and other reasons that researchers believe that they are used. The most typically referenced justification, and in my view, the most compelling, concerns trade secrets. In some cases, businesses must share trade secrets with workers in order for them to be productive. But if the employer fears that workers will take these valuable secrets to competing businesses, it may hesitate to share them in the first place, with negative consequences for productivity. This is a reasonable concern. We have evidence that the relatively small group of workers with trade secrets are especially likely to have non-competes. But most workers with non-competes do not have trade secrets. For lower wage workers, this is particularly unlikely to be a serious issue. What else might account for the proliferation of non-competes? This is an area of ongoing study. In research with my colleagues, we found that workers at multi-establishment firms are especially likely to have non-competes. This may be because those firms have more developed HR practices and infrastructure that allow them to deploy the contracts. There are likely other differences between firms that we can connect with use of non-competes. But the bigger picture many researchers have come to see is that non-competes are often driven by employers' desire to reduce their turnover and to gain leverage in wage negotiations. Without the possibility of easily moving to a competing firm, workers are in a weaker position when seeking better wages and working conditions. As we have learned about the conditions under which workers typically sign these contracts, this account has become more credible. Importantly, it appears that non-competes are typically presented to workers after the job offer was accepted. In a survey of electrical engineers, nearly half of workers actually reported having signed their non-competes on or after the first day of work. This is not a moment at which workers can make an informed decision with a reasonable opportunity to decline. Indeed, only a very small minority of all workers with non-competes report actually negotiating over them. Moreover, workers are more likely to be taken advantage of when they have limited information about how the contracts can be enforced. There is much worker confusion over this. Workers in states that enforce less stringently or not at all are generally unaware that this is the case and often respond to non-competes as if they are enforceable when they are not. State enforcement regimes do differ widely. California, North Dakota, and Oklahoma generally do not enforce non-competes. Other states vary in the details. For example, some states, like Minnesota, allow non-competes to be enforced even against workers who are laid off. Another way that state law varies is in how willing courts are to modify unenforceable contracts. which has implications for whether employers feel comfortable writing aggressive, overly broad non-competes. Now, I would like to turn to the research on how non-competes affect workers, businesses, and the overall economy. I'll start with the effects on workers, which is the subject of some exciting new analysis. One of the most useful studies in this area looks at a policy change in Oregon that made non-competes unenforceable for hourly paid workers. The authors of that study found that wages for those workers were higher after the change. Another study examined wage changes for tech workers in Hawaii after the state made their non-competes unenforceable. Similarly, this reform boosted their wages. These findings are consistent with other work showing that less stringent enforcement of non-competes is associated with higher wages. Moreover, low-wage workers seem to benefit the most when non-competes are less strictly enforced. Wages aren't the only outcome one might care about. One consequence of non-competes has been studied is the tendency for them to cause career detours. Non-competes cause some workers to leave their industries or states in order to escape their non-compete contracts. The same study of Hawaiian tech workers that I mentioned a moment ago also found that workers were more mobile after the reform. Somewhat surprisingly, non-competes also appear to reduce the mobility of workers who do not have non-competes. When firms are looking to hire in an industry where many workers have non-competes, there is less incentive to spend time and money recruiting, which makes it more difficult to find jobs, even for those workers without non-competes. On the positive side of the ledger, stringent non-compete enforcement leads to somewhat more worker training by firms. This makes sense. Non-competes make it harder for workers to leave, which in turn makes employers more confident that they will reap the rewards of training their workers. However, the results from the wage studies I just mentioned suggest that the relatively small training increases are not enough to offset the other negative effects for workers. This is a good moment to switch gears and discuss effects on businesses. It is helpful to distinguish businesses and their role as employers of particular workers versus businesses in their role as potential hirers. Obviously, any given employer will have both roles, but non-competes have sharply different effects in each case. For businesses trying to hang on to existing workers and pay them less, non-competes are helpful. The wage and turnover reductions I described a moment ago are contributions to the employer's bottom lines. However, hiring is more difficult when non-competes are common or when they're strictly enforced. This is especially a problem for entrepreneurs. When non-competes are more strictly enforced, there are fewer startups, which on average are less likely to survive. Even when they do survive, they tend to grow more slowly. One study also finds that women entrepreneurs are more limited by non-competes than male counterparts. So what does this mean for the overall economy? There are three main issues I worry about here. Investment in human capital and trade secrets, having productive matches between employer or workers and firms, and the spread of new innovations. As I mentioned a little while earlier, we do have evidence that non-competes raise investment, but the effect is small. A new paper compares the benefits of that extra investment with the costs of worse matches between workers and businesses. Intuitively, non-competes prevent workers from finding the best place for them to use their talent, and this reduces labor productivity. The author uses data on publicly listed firms to show that the costs of non-competes substantially outweigh the benefits. A different issue is that non-competes can prevent new discoveries and innovations from spreading broadly through the economy. One study demonstrates this using patent citations, finding that strict enforcement of non-competes causes a large reduction in citations within states. This effect is not especially surprising because it has long been known that workers moving across businesses is one way that innovation spread. Having just summarized much of the new research on non-competes, I'd now like to connect it with proposals for reform. Those proposals have taken on a variety of forms. Just weeks ago, the Federal Trade Commission proposed that non-competes can be broadly prohibited. However, it remains very unclear whether this proposal will ultimately be implemented and sufficiently enforced. Other proposals and enacted reforms at the state level have tended to be more narrowly tailored, specifying groups of workers who are ineligible for non-competes. Earlier, I mentioned Oregon's reform that rendered non-competes unenforceable for hourly paid workers. More recently, Washington State, Illinois, Virginia, and other states have disallowed non-competes for those earning below a certain income level. In my view, income thresholds are common because the argument in favor of non-competes for lower wage workers has little justification in the evidence. Lower wage workers are unlikely to possess trade secrets, and the research finds that they are particularly vulnerable to the harms of non-competes. Another common provision in the reform proposals, garden leave, is interesting because it requires employers to have skin in the game. If a particular non-compete contract is really needed to protect vital employer interests, like trade secrets, then the employer will find it worthwhile to pay for garden leave. Conversely, if a particular contract is not safeguarding vital employer interests, the employer can elect not to use it with that worker. What might employers do instead of using non-competes? There are a variety of alternatives to non-competes that are often more narrowly tailored to the need at hand. For example, non-disclosure and intellectual property agreements can directly address trade secrets without preventing a worker from taking new jobs. A non-solicitation agreement can stop an employee from taking a client list to a competing firm, but again, without broadly restricting the ability of the employer to work, the employee to work. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I would be happy to follow up with any information that the committee might find useful. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hogan. Members, any discussion on the bill? Testifiers? Okay, we've got two other testifiers, I'm sorry. Kurt Erickson, you want to come forward?
Hi, my name is Kurt Erickson. I'm a lawyer in Minneapolis. I work at Littler Mendelson, which is a labor and employment firm that does management side labor and employment. I've been involved with dealing with non-compete agreements probably for the last 15 years, both in terms of enforcing them as well as defending against them. And that includes both for companies as well as individuals. I have some concerns with regard to this bill, which I think I wanted to share with you for purposes of your consideration with regard to it. So let me start kind of at the beginning and just get right into the text of the bill. In subdivision one of the bill talks about restricting employees with regard to their ability to compete. That language is fairly broad in terms of dealing with whether or not a non-solicitation agreement like your previous testifier talked about would be proper under this agreement or not, and also deals with the issue of non-disclosure and whether or not the non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement would be permissible under this bill. When we turn to the next subdivision, which is B, it talks about the employee having earned, past tense, an annual salary from the employer an annual salary equal to a median family income. That connotes that you actually have to have earned a salary for a particular period of time before you can enter into the agreement. That's really contrary to the way that non-competes work. As Ms. Hogan talked about, non-competes are generally entered into at the time that you start employment, not some later point in time with regard to that. A lot of the companies that I have represented are medium and small-sized companies. I think the larger companies in our state aren't going to have a particular dog in this fight, if you will, with regard to this. It's going to be the companies that are trying to build themselves up with regard to broadening their customer base, coming up with innovation, things like that. They're the ones who are going to be impacted with regard to this. Let me start in terms of dealing with the median family income, or not as the basis for the threshold. That is going to be a difficult standard for businesses to deal with as that fluctuates on a year-by-year basis. Whether or not, in fact, a person is making this amount of money, whether or not they dip below it, whether or not they go on, an employee goes on leave or is demoted or suspended, all those things are now going to affect whether or not a non-compete, which was agreed to by everyone, is enforceable. That's a real problem for companies that don't have a lot of resources to spend on human resources with regard to this. And it requires constant monitoring with regard to this. Those are things that make enforcement of the agreements indefinite. And that's what we really don't want. We either want the agreements to be enforceable or not, and we don't want them fluctuating as we go along. Another example of whether or not an agreement is enforceable or not, often we will have employees who want to work part-time after having started full-time for whatever reason. Under this proposal, it's not clear that any non-compete that they had at the beginning of their employment when they were full-time would in fact continue on. One of the things that the committee and Representative Elkins should consider is whether it should be a rate of pay as opposed to a median family income with regard to the threshold, if we're going to go down the road of threshold. The other thing is the reality of how many of the businesses that I work with pay their employees. They will have a salary basis of, let's say, $50,000 or $60,000 with the opportunity to make up to 100% or more of what the base is with regard to that. That means under this bill, when you're talking about, and I think the phrases are salary and base salary, that those businesses cannot protect their customer lists or their trade secrets with regard to this, because their base salary is going to be under that number with regard to that. The garden leave provision, as far as I know, and I've talked with some of the folks in our firm, and we're a firm that does labor and employment across the country, is extremely unique to Minnesota and is not something that we've seen in other places. And I wanted to share with you an example of kind of a nightmare scenario involving this that I would have dealt with if this law was in place. I've had clients dealing with enforcement of non-competes after an employee has been left who's been embezzling from customers, stealing money from customers. And that employee is then fired with regard to that because they've taken money from the customers of the company. They want that non-compete to be enforceable against that employee, or at that point, former employee. And the issue arises under this bill, as the way it's drafted now, as to whether or not after having fired the person for stealing, we're now going to have to pay him 50% of his combined average annual salary for the restricted period, which generally speaking is going to be 1 year, approximately 1 year. So there's no limit here with regard, there's no qualification with regard to that. And let me kind of finish my remarks with regard to the bill, kind of in the, with what I probably should have started with in the first place. This bill really comes off as a solution looking for a problem. Having practiced in Minnesota non-compete law for about 15 years, I have seen zero cases in which an employee, a company has been enforcing a non-compete with somebody making $20 per hour. I haven't seen it. I haven't represented anyone dealing with that. I haven't enforced or tried to enforce a contract, a non-compete against somebody with that kind of a situation. Minnesota already has in place a situation where we narrowly construe non-compete laws. That's been the law in the state for years. It hasn't changed. So we're already doing that with regard to that. If an agreement is onerous, Minnesota law provides for blue penciling. I don't know if you're familiar with that doctrine or not, but the doctrine in Minnesota, and again, this doctrine has been around for decades, which is if a non-compete agreement is onerous, including on, you know, and usually on the employee, right? Never on the employer. The agreement can be modified by the court to make it less onerous and to make it reasonable. That is the law right now in the federal courts of Minnesota and the state courts of Minnesota, and has been for a long time. So my business is litigation, so I listened intently to Ms. Hogan's comments and really Ryan Nunn's comments, so I'm going to give you my two cents based on the comments that I heard. Okay. When I hear somebody say that our best guess in Minnesota is that there are 350,000 non-competes, based on quote unquote extrapolating from national data, I think to myself, would that be admissible in a court of law? I don't think so. I'd be up and down on that, saying there's a lack of foundation and lack of admissibility with regard to that. So I'm really concerned about whether or not that kind of a statement should be relied upon by this committee for purposes of making a decision. I heard that non-competes are often entered into after the first day of work. Two things are really important to consider here. And again, you go back to non-compete law in Minnesota. One is we have a wage theft law now since 2019, which says the terms and conditions have to be agreed to and signed off on by the employee as they start employment. And I hear nothing in Ms. Hogan's comments addressing that reality with regard to Minnesota requirements with regard to that. The other thing is there's a very big strain or strand of law in Minnesota that if I start employment and then I'm working along and then you hand me a non-compete agreement and say, oh, by the way, could you please sign this agreement? There's a strand in Minnesota law that says, listen, if you're going to do that, then you have to offer that employee additional consideration with regard to entering into that, because the employee is already employed. I heard nothing in Ms. Hogan's comments about that reality in Minnesota law. I think I've talked about the blue pencil and being overly broad with regard to that, in terms of the terms. I heard about the effect on the overall economy, and I'm struck by the fact that Minnesota's unemployment rate right now, with the current state of non-compete law, is one of the lowest that it's ever had. What I heard when I heard that if we don't have non-competes, that quote-unquote innovation spreads, what I heard was that means that basically the customer goodwill that I built up in making this business or the trade secrets that I innovated can now be more readily, quote-unquote, spread. I don't think that's fair. I think if I was the person or the group of owners that built a business and built that customer list or built those innovations, I don't think they ought to be spread without my consent if you've signed an agreement. That's all I have. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. If you want to hang close, if we have people have questions,
sure.
You need to call back up. Next person I have on the list is Justin Tersch. I don't see anyone running to the table. Okay, now, any questions of the bill or the testifiers? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Hogan, just a clarification.
You want to pull your microphone down, Representative McDonald, so that we get it on tape.
Very good, thank you. My question for you, Ms. Hogan, is you had a lengthy testimony, and if I heard correctly, we're with the feds, but this is not necessarily the feds' position. Is that correct?
Ms. Hogan.
Thank you, Chair. Representative McDonald. So, with the Fed, we're always required to be clear that when we're speaking, I am representing our views, not necessarily the view of the entire Federal Reserve System or on behalf of the Federal Reserve Bank. The testimony that I relayed today from Ryan Nunn, my colleague, who, like Representative Elkins noted, is an expert in this area, reflects the research that he and his team have done at the Federal Reserve Bank, but it's not an official Federal Reserve statement, if that makes sense.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it makes sense, but not really. I mean, because when you hear a testimony from the Federal Reserve, that's quite powerful, you could say. If I had a testifier that was with the Federal Reserve, I'd put that as a feather in my cap. But then your caveat is, well, but this is not what we promote. So there's a dichotomy there. It's a disconnect of some sort, but the world is strange nowadays.
If I may, I would say
Ms.
perhaps,
Hogan.
Thank you, Chair. You know, perhaps it's equivalent to saying that you cannot speak for the entire Republican Party in your statements. That's just a gander.
Representative McDonald.
Is it that obvious I'm a Republican? I never even stated that. Okay, duly said, duly noted. Mr. Chair, then a question for the author. So I'm just trying to get my head around this as a businessman, a small businessman in Delano. So if someone came to me, or if I had the thought, say, hey, we should pass a law in Minnesota that we have no competes, and on top of it, you can hire someone, an employee, they can come in, you as an employer, you can teach them, and all the secrets of the trade secrets, the proprietary elements of your business, some top secret things, and then you could just take it and go wherever you want and open up your own business right across the street. And on top of it, we're going to pay you 50% not to do it of your salary. That just seems like alien to me. That if I had that thought, I'd think, well, that's a crazy thought. I would never do that. I would never present that as a lawmaker. And if a constituent or someone from the Capitol came up to me and said, hey, we should have no competes, and then we should have an employer pay the employee not to compete, even though we're having no competes. That just seems so astonishing to me and crazy, if for lack of a better word. So just curious how this developed, Representative Elkins, and why is it important? And don't you think it would harm many businesses, especially startups and entrepreneurs who put the time and money and investment, think Shark Tank, I don't know if anybody wants a Shark Tank, but Mr. Wonderful often talks about the proprietary elements of a business and the importance of it. Well, if you got rid of that element, your investors would say, well, I'm not going to invest $100,000 even for 50% because it's a non-compete. So just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Sure, Representative
Elkins.
McDonald. You know, I think that the concerns that you're expressing about employees walking out the door with trade secrets generally are going to be better expressed through a non-disclosure agreement. Over the course of my career, I've signed dozens of non-disclosure agreements which prevent me from walking out the door with trade secrets and taking them to my next employer or starting a new business of myself. You don't need to, you know, tell the person at Great Clips that they can't go to work anywhere else because they went through a Great Clips training program. It's just, what is the most appropriate tool to prevent the scenario that you're describing? And in most cases, it's going to be a non-disclosure agreement, not a non-compete agreement.
Representative McDonald.
Thank
One
you,
more
sir.
Question, then I have somebody else on the list, then we can get back to you.
Yes, thank you, Representative Elkins. Certainly makes sense. I guess you wouldn't want a stylist not to work across the street, or a photographer. I had some assistants that I trained very well, and they became very good photographers and then opened up a studio just very close to me. Mm-hmm. It was my fault for not having a non-disclosure or a non-compete, but
whatever.
I'm a nice guy, you know. But what's the thoughts of what the lawyer thinks of your comment on that, the last testifier?
I think he expressed them.
Mr. Erickson.
Yeah.
Mr. Eric.
And then that's the last question, Mr.
Well, like I said, we can sure. get back. I want to give everybody a chance.
Yeah.
Mr. Erickson.
Yes, and could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Oh, I forgot it. Sorry.
Was it? It's the idea of having.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Having people next to each other and.
Yes, based upon Representative Elkins' comment that there's non-compete disclosures when an employer hires an employee. So the that material is proprietary and not stolen, but he said his bill is to prevent a Great Clip stylist from working at one clip company and then going across the street and working for the other one. Wouldn't that be this case, Representative Elkins?
Well, that's the kind of thing that would not be to be allowed. I mean, that's a very common. In fact, I think Great Clips does require that. My own stylists have sometimes worked at Great Clips and. Pretty clear that they, you know, if you work at Great Clips, you need to sign a non-compete agreement. And I don't know if that's appropriate for somebody who's making $15, $20 an hour.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Eric, then do you want
to?
Had a Great Clips case, so I hesitate to comment with regard to that. The people that I've dealt with are generally out. Salespeople working outside of a particular location and looking to make money that will boost them over $100,000 or more in terms of their earnings. I think I said in my testimony that with regard to the rate of pay, that may be a floor that could be added with regard to this, and a rate of pay like $30 or $35 an hour. Might in fact eliminate, but I can imagine if you're the owner of the Great Clips and you're trying to build up a customer clientele and then somebody leaves and goes right across the street and takes the customers that they had been taking, I can see whether you would consider that to be an infringement if you've signed a non-compete and if I've given you all the assets and training necessary to start your own business.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Elkins, you know, we live in a state where we've got a lot of very, you know, innovative businesses. We also have some, you know, very innovative people that live here. And a lot of those people want to, you know, become entrepreneurs, start a business for themselves. And, you know, I think it's important that, you know, we look at not a one-size-fits-all because to get people to invest their own money or to have investors come in or to build a business and to employ people, taking away some of these tools can be detrimental. You know, a question I would have for you is, you know, have you spoken to small or medium employers in the tech or medical industry to see, you know, what their feedback has been on this.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I would start off by saying I took Mr. Erickson's business card because he presented a lot of really good ideas today. So it will probably seem some amendments to the bill reflecting his testimony. But you look at an industry like MedTech as a perfect example because Minnesota has become a center for medical technology. But a lot of the, you know, and we have more, far more than our share of startups in that particular industry. And a lot of people who have founded those startup companies, you know, have come from some of the large companies in the area. And if you talk to some of them, they'll say, well, I had an idea and they didn't want to, you know, the company didn't want to go forward with it. So I split off on my own and founded my own company. That's the source of a lot of new startup businesses in Minnesota. You would not want to dampen, you know, those kinds of frustrated employees from founding a new company to pursue their idea. And if you, if these people are all bound by, you know, strict non-compete agreements, it would actually stifle innovation in that industry.
Representative Myers.
Okay, so I'll take that probably as a no talking to them. You know, we've heard some real world experiences and, you know, being an attorney myself, represent a lot of small business owners and, you know, having this opportunity and this tool, you know, to protect their business, but also to grow the business. Again, a lot of times these are entrepreneurs starting businesses and they want to make sure that they're protecting their investment as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we've seen and heard that, you know, there's opportunities to, make this bill better, and I appreciate you taking his card. You know, the idea of rate of pay is much more, I'll say, intriguing to me to look at what that would look like.
Yeah, lots of notes here.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. I mean, you know, it's, you know, nothing's ever perfect, and taking that input is really important. So I appreciate you coming here and talking through it. The other question I would have is, if this bill was to pass, is this a retroactive?
Representative.
I think it, yes.
I think we got the attorney for the back said the answer is no. So
I'll accept that answer, yes.
Okay, just making sure that we can look at that because there is pretty well-established law on this. I don't think that there's, you know, there is things that we can do to better inform, you know, our employees and making sure that employers are telling them from the outset, here's the job offer, here it is. Because if that consideration is missing, then yeah, it's not enforceable. So I appreciate you listening and being here. Thank you.
Can I just comment? I think that is a big part of the problem. Mr. Erickson noticed that he's never had a $20 an hour employee as a client. Well, they wouldn't be able to afford him as a client. But there is a substantial amount of case law that does already, you know, restrict some practices. Like in Minnesota, if you present the non-compete, you know, if you don't present the non-compete actually at the time the job offer is made, it's not enforceable. But how many employees would know that? They're going to sign this agreement that they've had and assume that, you know, without anything explicit in the law, that they have to abide with it, even if it's not unenforceable. Not enforceable, because as you know, we did have testimony that many cases these non-compete agreements are tendered to the employee long after the job offer is tendered, and that's just not right.
And one follow-up to that, and I know there's other standards that can be in there as far as time frame restriction as well. And I, again, you know, personally, and just the implementation and operation of the real world, you know, looking at some of those. Restrictions on time versus a one-size-fits-all, I think, would be if you were to be open to that.
Yeah. Well, this bill has two more stops.
Representative Oak. Mm-hmm. Representative Greenman, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And I wanted to, I think, that to hit on what Representative Elkins said, which is, I think, in response to this is actually a problem looking for a solution. And when we talk about unenforceable, we've seen, and I think when we heard this bill last year, we heard from a bunch of workers who talked about having a non-compete that probably was unenforceable in the law. Mm-hmm. But as a lawyer, What we know is it's not just people who make $20 an hour who don't get a lawyer on these things. I know people who make six figures who sign these things, and when they're ready to go, they just take the restriction as something that they're required to do. And I think that when we talk about that, that is an impact far beyond what we see playing out in court. Something that I think is important for us lawyers to note is that we legally, our professional conduct rules prohibit us from signing non-competes. And so as it relates to Mr. Erickson, Representative Meyer and I, we actually can't enter into non-competes. And what the Minnesota court rules say is an agreement restricting the rights of lawyers to practice after leaving a firm not only limits their professional autonomy, but limits the freedom of clients to choose a lawyer. So I think that when we think about if it's good enough for lawyers, we should think about what's good enough for us. I guess my question is, I take to heart some of the questions you raise about thresholds, Representative, or Mr. Erickson. And one of my questions is, I think Oregon and California, maybe we should eliminate the thresholds and just get to preventing these non-competes all outright. So I guess it's a question for you, Mr. or Representative Elkins, or maybe Ms. Hogan.
Thank you,
Representative Elkins.
Representative Greenman. So I know that my Senate author, Senator Elise Mann, shares that feeling. She does not like this the garden leave provision at all. And so it may be something that doesn't survive at the end of the day.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Mr. Erickson, if you could come up. I want to clarify the question that I asked earlier.
This exercise that day going back. Mr. Erickson. Mm. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm going to keep hair cutting out of the question here. But wait till Ken, the barber downstairs, realizes you don't go to him, Representative Elkin. He's not going to be happy.
He probably owns that business himself.
He does.
Actually his son owns the business. He sold it to his son. Uh-huh. But Representative McDonald.
Yes, we digress. So should Representative Elkin's bill become law, for non-competes, what does that do to a non-disclosure contract?
Mr. Erickson.
The law is presently written. Talks about covenant not to compete means an agreement and employment between an employee and employer that restricts the employee after termination from performing work for another employer for a specified time, work for another employer in a capacity that is similar to the employer's work for that employer that is a party to the agreement. I think it calls into question whether or not this is a ban on non-solicitations. It also edges up to whether or not a confidentiality agreement would or would not be enforceable. That may not be the intent of the author, but as presently written, it puts it in doubt.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. That's what I had thought, because Representative Elkins, you did say that non-disclosures covers that. So that was the concern that we had in this.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
that's one of the items I made a note on as something that where the bill could be approved.
Representative McDonald.
And that's what I appreciate about working with you, Representative Elkins. We've been working together often, and I find that you've done that. I've observed that several times, that you take into consideration and are willing to make a bill better. Mm-hmm. And I think that should be duly noted to all of us lawmakers here on each side, that we're not so stubborn and in our way, that we know all things without having some help with the experts. So I appreciate that, Representative Elkins. And then I have a closing thought, but
why don't you give your closing thought, and if there's no one else, we'll get to the vote.
Well,
Representative McDonald.
I'm sure that we all have startups or niche markets or entrepreneurs in our districts. And certainly I don't think any of them would be in favor of this particular non-compete bill. I think they'd have grave concerns over this. And I think it would stifle creativity, entrepreneurship, and investment. So we do have some concerns with that, Representative Elkins, and I hope that I see that you recognize some of those concerns. And because of that, I do request a roll call. I think it's an important vote, and I'd like to request a roll call, and do have some grave concerns with this for our businesses in the future.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Any other final comments? I'm just going to make one. In my years of working for contractors, it was some contractors that worked with each other. Owners kind of had, they wouldn't poach another contractor's employees because they kind of treat them like they're my employees, like they own them. I know one contractor I worked for, I got laid off on a Wednesday, and I got called into the office, and it was, he said, I suppose by the time I call you back, you're going to be working for somebody else. And I looked him in the eye and said, I got a family to feed. I got bills to pay. If I get another contractor hires me, I'm going to work for them. Thursday night, I got a call from him saying he found work for me and sent me someplace to work, and I was working for him, and he kept me busy because he didn't want to lose me. And so, I mean, there's a lot of times I've seen other carpenters that I worked with that would say, no, I'll wait for you to call me back, and they don't get called back. And so it's unofficial non-compete clauses there. It's just the way things go in the real world out there. So with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 295, as amended, be referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. You looked up, okay, what's that?
Mr. Chair, this could go over either to Judiciary or Commerce. I'm fine with Commerce.
I got Commerce on my list here, that's so fine. We'll go there. Mm-hmm. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Vice Chair Berg?
Aye.
Berg, aye. Lead McDonald?
No.
McDonald, nay. Representative Daniels?
No.
Daniels, nay. Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Hill?
Hill, aye.
Hill, aye. Representative Hussein?
Aye.
Hussein, aye. Representative Jordan?
Aye.
Jordan, aye. Representative Kozlowski?
Aye.
Kozlowski, aye. Representative Meckland?
No.
Meckland, nay. Representative Myers?
Nay.
Myers, nay. Representative Schultz is excused. Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Mr. Chair, at the conclusion of roll call, there are 8 ayes and 4 nays.
With 8 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. The bill's on its way to Commerce.
Thank you.
The next bill on our order, and I'm going to switch chairs here, is House File 62, and it's my bill. Madam Chair.
One moment, Chair Nelson. Before we begin the hearing on this bill, could I ask if Representative Myers had a chance to look at the minutes for January 26th, and would you move the minutes?
I was ready.
Yeah, I'll approve the minutes.
Great. Everybody who approves the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
I'll move House File 62 to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Rep. Nelson moves that HF 62 be referred to Ways and Means. Rep. Nelson, would you also move the author's amendment, A6?
Madam Chair, I will move the A6 amendment and members. What the A6 amendment does is we've been working with Minkoji and with the advocates for this bill to try and come up with the exact language of on the hearings and on data on whether how it's private and non-private and public. So, but this is the final drafting on this, and we've come to an agreement with the different groups on this. So that's what this amendment does. Plus it raises the amount that's in the bill from $500,000 a year to $750,000 a year to help the per board operate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All those in favor of adopting the A6 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Chair Nelson, please explain your bill.
Madam Chair, members, this bill is about the PERB Board, which is the Public Employee Relations Board. For years, we've had this board on the books. We really hasn't been able to function because we haven't funded it at a very minimum, other than a very minimum level. This is a Representative Carlson passed this a few years back, and he's been trying over the years to get it funded. He handed it off to me as he walked out of the chamber and said, "It's my baby now." But the reason for this is the Public Employee Relations Board is when public employers and in public employees, when they have disputes, currently they have to go to court to get those settled. And that costs money not only for the employee or the employee's union, but also for the employer. So this is our public employers, our cities, our counties, the state employees, or the employers anyway, that they have to go to court to solve this out, and it costs them money. By having this board up and operating, these simple disputes that can be settled here, they can go there, they can work them out, be mediated, and that will, then they can take the problem can be solved. I'm stumbling over my tongue today. Anyway, so that's what the Public Employee Relations Board is supposed to do. And with me, I have Meg Luger here, who is currently the head of the board, and so she can explain a little bit more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Meg Luger Nikolai. I'm the current chair and union representative for the Public Employment Relations Board, and I'm here obviously to speak in favor of this bill. Grateful for the committee's time. If PERB was a baby, it would be a second grader right now, and I feel like we did a good job of getting PERB past its infancy and set up for moving around, but we now need to fully fund it so, you know, it can go to school and I'm not embarrassed about its genes and stuff. So what we'd like to talk, so just a little bit of background, PERB was open for a brief period between July 1st, 2020 and June 30th, 2021. During that time, we operated as leanly as possible because we had the $125,000 funding grant for both years. And we were only ever able to hire a 0.3 executive director. MMB did not let us hire people for whom we could not pay wages, which we support, generally speaking. And so we were very, very fortunate to be able to work with a couple of retirees who were willing to give of their time in retirement. But now we're here hoping that we can actually employ some additional staff. So we're grateful for this bill because it provides us the funding. And I think now might be a good time to talk a little bit about that $750,000. Right now, we're not seeking a fiscal note. This is a direct appropriation. But we have tried to work with MMB to have some understanding of the labor costs. We are aware that we are looking to hire three staff, an investigator, an executive director, and an admin support for these individuals, again, to replace our very excellent, very much grateful for Chief Cook and Bottle Washer, whom we've had for the last couple of years. So those costs we've gotten from MMB are estimates because they can't band a position or give us a firm number until we actually have an appropriation. So we've borrowed from other agencies. The investigator cost should be around $90,000. The executive director cost should be somewhere between $110,000 and $120,000 annually, and an admin support would be around $55,000. Those are exclusive of benefits, so those are straight salary costs. Additionally, PERB has normal operational costs that you might imagine. We got to pay for our internets and we got to pay for phones as well as our email addresses every month. And so we need to make those costs, we have to be able to pay for those. We also will be conducting investigations, and there is a cost entailed for that as well. You have to produce evidence. You may be going to investigate witnesses in the field or parties in the field. And so those are all things that cost money. Additionally, the PERB, as well as being, it is an investigative board and a deliberative board. If there's merit found in a case, it gets kicked to a hearing officer, and we contract with those individuals to hear those cases as well. So that is another price point for us. So that is what we're imagining. We are projecting based on the fully staffed agency that we hope that we have, but we still would like to note that this is an extremely tiny appropriation in light of the overall state budget. And Representative Nelson, Chair Nelson, did a great job of summarizing the policy changes that we've requested, but we obviously support those as well for two reasons. First of all, it enables us to deliberate on cases in closed session, which is important to us. We haven't had the ability to do that. As it turns out, we don't get a lot of visitors to our meetings, but we think that's going to change. We're going to be very popular. And like other agencies, licensing agencies, the judiciary, you know, we want to have the opportunity to deliberate as colleagues and decision makers privately, and then obviously make public the important aspects of our decision making. Also, we are collecting a lot of government data. This is an agency that works with public employees and public employers, so we are collecting data we're collecting government data in the hands of its original holders. We want to ensure that those classifications remain the same, while also ensuring that a significant amount of information, if you look at the bulleted pieces of info that will be public, remain public, so that we're not operating obviously in the dark or in an opaque way. And so those are the changes to the open meeting law and the DPA, the Data Practices Act, that we believe will help us function a little bit more efficiently and appropriately. And so that's really the nuts and bolts. Again, appreciate the committee's time and appreciate Representative Nelson's willingness to grab this toddler and keep it moving.
Thank you, Ms. Luger. Before we go to questions, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I would like to thank Chair Nelson. Just like with anything, sometimes with legislation, it's very important that there not be confusion of what is public or what is not public. Chair Nelson, along with Minkoji and myself, there was a lot of discussion and a lot of emails, and I appreciate that, because what it does in the long run, and if anyone knows about myself, I'm a principle of transparency and with our government is so dang important. So once again, I thank you. We strike one for sunshine here.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Seeing no further testifiers, discussion on the bill.
Well, we got time, Madam Chair.
Representative, pardon me, Lead McDonald.
Thank you. Question, Representative Nelson, regarding the Workers' Compensation Division right now and how we're not, that currently is working, is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, it is. And this doesn't touch the Workers' Compensation Board. This has to do with employee relations between the public employers and the public employees.
Lead McDonald.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, well, I don't pretend to know everything about the intricacies of both of those divisions and the PERB at this point, but right now, under your bill, the governor would appoint how many people to, how many folks that would be on this panel?
Chair Nelson.
I think Ms. Luger can answer that question.
Ms. Luger.
Lead McDonald, the answer to your question is that currently the governor appoints four members. So there is a management representative, a union representative, or a labor representative, and then each of those has a backup alternate to avoid conflicts. Those two individuals appoint a neutral, and then there's a backup for the neutral and alternate as well.
Madam Chair, thank you. And so what system do we have now that deals with the employee-employer differences?
Ms. Luger.
Madam Chair and Lead McDonald, if there is currently this year, if there is a labor dispute involving an unfair labor practice, and that's a violation of Minnesota Statute 179A.13, Subdivision 2, and the subparts that follow, if there's a violation, they got to sue it out in court. So it goes to a district court judge.
Lead McDonald.
Madam Chair, so then it goes to an unbiased judge.
Ms. Luger.
Madam Chair, to the extent that the premise suggests that it goes to an unbiased anyone other than that, I can't necessarily go with you there, but it would go to a judge that is appointed in the regular fashion that all judges in the state of Minnesota are, and then subsequently elected.
Lead McDonald.
Madam Chair, so the panel that it would be appointed by the governor, for the one for the employee and one for the employer, no matter what governor is in charge, history would dictate that there would be a bias there. So you're taking a non-biased judge at this point and put it into a new system that there probably will be biases towards the employee and not the employer.
Ms. Lugar?
Madam Chair and Lead McDonald, I want to be clear that we take our duties as arbiters and not arbitrators, but arbiters of a dispute very seriously and review it in as unbiased a fashion as any human being can. As you're probably aware, we live with particular biases in the world, and that's how we as humans make decisions. But those of us who've taken on the role of being decision makers have an obligation to review every dispute that comes in front of them, not as in the lens of their particular party affiliation or in any other way, but rather the serious job of trying to resolve disputes in an efficient fashion to help the taxpayers of Minnesota and the public employees and employers before them.
Chair McDonald?
Yeah, I'm sure. Just lastly, then, I'm just curious, Representative Nelson, just since the system is working now, why open the door for a potential bias in the future if what we have now with, we have, what, 9 judicial districts that work throughout the state of Minnesota. In this panel, I presume that they're not going to be going through all areas of the state. So why change it at this point and open the door to a potential bias in the future, no matter what governor is in the office?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, again, it's about money. We always talk about saving money in government, making government more efficient so it doesn't cost as much. By going to having this PERB board, which is will deal with these issues and solely these issues, it keeps the employers, the state, the public employers, be it whether they're cities, townships, counties, or the state, having to hire a lawyer and go to court. That costs a lot more money than having people be able to sit down with arbiters that are picked, one from management, one from labor, or one from the employee side, and they pick an independent arbiter to oversee it, and then they hear the cases, and they come to a decision, and most of the times they can come to a decision without having to go to court on it. Again, that saves money for both sides of the balance scale. It saves money for the employers, and it saves money for the employees.
Lead McDonald?
Madam Chair, that's a great idea, Representative Ellison. Then why not do it for the public or the private employees as well?
Chair Nelson.
Employers.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, we do currently do have that. That's called the National Labor Relations Board.
Ms. Lugar?
Yep, Madam Chair, I'd also like to offer up that the board as it's currently constituted is not dissimilar from the National Mediation Board, which is available under the RLA, the Railway Labor Act, and that provides also for a neutral, as well as a representative from each side of the dispute. So those are actually pretty typical analogous structures in other areas of labor law as well.
Lead McDonald?
That's great. Thank you. That's all I have, except one last thing, Representative Nelson. It does cost the taxpayers money, as in your amendment, $750,000 this year and $750,000 next year. So it does cost money, correct?
Chair Nelson?
Madam Chair and Representative Donald, but it'll save money in court costs. It'll save money in lawyers' fees from both sides having to move that forward. And that's what we're looking to do.
Very good.
Any further questions? Representative Mecklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What would the qualifications be to be selected as a unbiased arbiter?
Ms.
Neutral arbiter, rather.
Madam Chair, so when we did RFPs for the hearing officers, the requirement was that they hold a JD and that they have some experience in labor disputes. So the two individuals that we've hired as contractors to hear these disputes are both pretty experienced arbitrators, and that was one of the reasons that we thought that they brought a great deal of expertise to this particular milieu, the public sector labor dispute context.
Representative Mecklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to have a question. So what I think you said that your current funding is $125,000 a year. That's correct. Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair. What specifically is driving, because originally in the bill you had $500,000, Representative Nelson, and now we were going to add up an additional $250,000. So this is like grew from the original draft to an amendment. What drove it up $250,000 in a short period of time?
Chair Nelson.
Madam Chair and Representative Mecklen, when we put the bill in, we put the bill in with the language that that we had last year. That's actually the, we had this bill last year, and we did not get it passed and across the finish line. And the cost was set for when we put the bill in from what it was last year. The board came to us and they said, this is what we think it's going to cost us. This is what we think we need to do to make this operate. Right now, July 1, this board will go into effect with no money, if this bill does not pass. This is giving the board a chance to get upset up and get ready to go, and so that they can hire the positions and do the job that they're supposed to do.
Representative Mecklen?
That's fine. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Chair, Lead McDonald.
Just one last question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Just curious, will the board then travel to the various places of the state, or will people travel to the board?
Ms. Luger?
Madam Chair, that is a great question, which is right now when the board itself operates, we are borrowing space from the BMS, whom we are grateful to work with all the time. And so we are situated in St. Paul. The expectation is that investigation may take folks, investigators, afield from St. Paul. So, yeah, that would be an expectation that I would have, certainly as a member.
Lead McDonald.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. See, I do ask some good questions once in a while. Thank you for the compliment.
Rep. Nelson, Chair Nelson, any final comments on the bill? Seeing no other questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing the bill. Hopefully we can get this across the goal line and get it passed, and we can invite Representative Carlson for a bill signing for something he's worked on for many years.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Chair Nelson renews his motion that HF 62 as amended be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, and the bill is re-referred.
Are we adjourned?
No further business before the committee. Our next hearing is Thursday, February 2nd. Yes, we are adjourned.